From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
My husband, Joe, was an iron worker. He spent 28 days at Ground Zero. He went knowing that they were going to need iron workers who knew how to cut steel. My husband has been declared 100% disabled due to his work at Ground Zero. He also suffers from a laundry list. He's been diagnosed with chronic rhinitis, chronic bronchitis, RADS, gastroreflux, musculoskeletal.
Today marks the 8th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Vigils will be held to remember the nearly 3,000 people killed. Today we look at a group of victims who are often forgotten, the thousands of rescue workers who became sick after being exposed to contaminants at Ground Zero. Hundreds have died. We'll speak with Joe Picuro, a New Jersey iron worker who worked as a volunteer on the pile for 28 days. He's now dying of lung disease. We'll also be joined by New York Congressmember Carolyn Maloney, co-sponsor of the 9/11 Health and Compensation Act. And we'll talk to Dr. Jacqueline Moline, director of the World Trade Center Medical Monitoring and Treatment Program at Mount Sinai Hospital. Then a Democracy Now! Exclusive, Adam Hermanson, a 25-year-old employee of the military contractor Triple Canopy, dies in Iraq. He was electrocuted while taking a shower at the company's base inside the Green Zone. Triple Canopy initially misled the family about how he died. The family is now seeking justice.
My son, Adam, was very proud to serve in the military and to serve his country and fight for his country. And now it's time for us to fight for Adam so that justice is served and so that the people who are responsible for doing this to Adam get what's coming to them.
We'll speak with Adam Hermanson's mother, Patricia, his 17-year-old brother, Jesse, and with investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill, who broke the story. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Newly released figures show a significant rise in the number of Americans who are living in poverty and going without health insurance. The Census Bureau says 2.6 million Americans were plunged into poverty last year, bringing the poverty rate to an 11-year high of 13.2%. It was the first major increase to the poverty rate since 2004. Median household income also fell 3.6%, the largest such decline on record. Meanwhile, the number of people without health insurance rose from 45.7 million to 46.3 million, the eighth straight year the ranks of the uninsured have grown. On Thursday, President Obama said the figures underscore the need for health care reform.
One part of the problem is the uninsured. And this morning, the Census Bureau released new data showing not only that the poverty rate increased last year at the highest rate since the early 1990s, but also that the number of uninsured rose in 2008. And we know from more up-to-date surveys that since the recession intensified last September, the situation's grown worse. Over the last 12 months, it's estimated that the ranks of the uninsured have swelled by nearly 6 million people. That's 17,000 men and women every single day.
Obama was speaking before the American Nurses Association in Washington. His comments came as Democratic leaders vowed to approve health care legislation before the end of the year. Speaking on NBC's Today Show, Vice President Joe Biden promised a bill before Thanksgiving.
We will have a bill. I believe we will have a bill. I went to Congress a long, long time, been there for eight presidents. I think we'll have a bill before Thanksgiving.
Share prices in the nation's top insurance companies have grown since President Obama's nationally televised speech on health care reform. During the address, Obama criticized insurers, but also said he wants to keep them in business. Obama also refused to insist on a government-funded public option and backed a proposal that would force Americans to carry health insurance, giving insurers millions of potential new customers. On Thursday, shares in major insurance companies, including United Health, WellPoint, and Cigna, rose between 1 to 4%. The investment research firm Sanford Bernstein says it's now, quote, even more confident after the Obama speech that the legislative outcomes will be moderate with no threat of a Medicare-like public plan. A leading advocacy group for single-payer health care, meanwhile, is criticizing Obama's proposal requiring Americans to purchase health insurance. Physicians for a National Health Program says the latest census figures show the mandate approach has failed in Massachusetts, where it became law in 2006. At least 352,000 Massachusetts residents, or 5.5%, were uninsured last year. The group's co-founder, Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler, said, quote, today's numbers show that plans that require people to buy private insurance don't work. Obama's plan to replicate Massachusetts reform nationally risks failure on a massive scale. The Senate Appropriations Committee has approved President Obama's $128 billion request to fund the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan for the coming fiscal year. The vote comes as top Democratic lawmakers have voiced new skepticism about a potential troop increase in Afghanistan. In an interview with the New York Times, Senate Armed Services Committee Chair Carl Levin said he opposes a troop increase until the U.S. improves the training of Afghan forces. Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi suggested she would oppose sending more U.S. troops to Afghanistan.
September 24th is fraught with meaning for us. This is the date, according to the supplemental, that the metrics as to what's going on in Afghanistan are to be reported to Congress. I'm more interested in that report. I hope that we will be briefed on the McChrystal when the president receives it, and that perhaps next week we will see that. I don't think there's a great deal of support for sending more troops to Afghanistan in the country or in the Congress.
Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, a UN commission has disqualified ballots from 83 polling stations in last month's national elections. Official results show Afghan President Hamid Karzai ahead with 54%, but his supporters have been accused of widespread fraud. The UN says it's also ordered recounts at hundreds of other polling stations. Iran has unveiled a new proposal that precludes talks on its uranium enrichment program, but calls for a global control system to eliminate nuclear weapons. The Iranian proposal also offers help in stabilizing Afghanistan, fighting terrorism, and developing energy projects. On Thursday, State Department spokesperson P.J. Crowley said the proposal fails to meet U.S. concerns, but will still be considered.
It is not really responsive to our greatest concern, which is obviously Iran's nuclear program. Iran has failed to meet its obligations, has failed to cooperate sufficiently with the IAEA. So we remain open to direct dialogue with Iran. If we can get to that point, we would expect to engage on the full range of issues, including our concerns about Iran's nuclear ambitions.
The U.S. has cut more aid to Honduras in protest of the coup overthrowing Honduran President Manuel Zelaya. The government-run Millennium Challenge Corporation is withholding $11 million in aid and another $4 million in funding for road construction in Honduras. The move comes 1 week after the State Department cut off around $30 million in aid to the Honduran coup regime. Controversy is brewing over the appointment of a top Bush administration official to a White House advisory panel on declassification. Michael Hayden, the former director of the National Security Agency and later the Central Intelligence Agency, has been tapped to join the Public Interest Declassification Board. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell appointed Hayden during the August recess. Hayden oversaw the Bush administration's warrantless spy program and aggressively backed CIA practices, including secret prisons and extraordinary rendition. He's recently opposed the release of government memos authorizing the use of torture, saying their disclosure would harm national security. President Obama says he's accepted an apology from Republican Congress member Joe Wilson for interrupting his health care speech on Wednesday. Wilson yelled out, "You lie," when Obama said his health plan wouldn't cover undocumented immigrants.
I'm a big believer that we all make mistakes. He apologized quickly and without equivocation, and I'm appreciative of that. I do think that, as I said last night, we have to get to the point where we can have a conversation about big, important issues that matter to the American people without vitriol, without name-calling, without the assumption of the worst in other people's motives.
Wilson's Democratic opponent, Rob Miller, has raised more than $405,000 in online donations since Wednesday night. In other news from Washington, Democratic Senator Tom Harkin has become the new chair of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. Harkin replaces the late Senator Ted Kennedy, who died last month. The National Endowment of the Arts has demoted a top appointee following criticism from the right-wing Fox News host Glenn Beck. Beck recently attacked the NEA's now former communications director, Yossi Sargent, for taking part in a conference call that discussed an Obama administration public service initiative. Beck says Sargent was trying to enlist artists to promote the administration's policies. The NEA denies the call had any political agenda, but says Sargent has been reassigned to a different position. Sargent's the second Obama appointee criticized by Beck to be ousted in the last week. The administration's special advisor for environmental jobs, Van Jones, stepped down over the weekend following attacks from Beck and other right-wing pundits. In New York, a Bronx cookie factory is closing its doors just weeks after its striking workers won a long-running dispute for back wages and reinstatement. The Connecticut-based private equity fund Brynwood Partners says it has sold the Stella Dora biscuit company to another firm that wants to move it to Ohio. Stella Dora workers returned to the job in July after winning an 11-month strike against pay cuts and benefit losses. Brynwood says it was forced to sell the factory because the workers wouldn't accept the cuts. The workers say they plan to fight the sale to keep their jobs. And meanwhile, in Chicago, the former chief executive of a window factory that gained notoriety for worker sit-ins has been arrested and held on $10 million bond. Richard Gilman is accused of conspiring to launder funds from Chicago's Republic Windows and Doors factory and secretly removing its equipment. The alleged offenses came around the time Gilman abruptly ordered the factory's closure to sell it to another company. Instead, workers occupied the plant to win back their severance and vacation pay. The factory has remained open under new management. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Vigils will be held today at the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and in Pennsylvania to remember the nearly 3,000 people killed 8 years ago in the September 11th attacks. In New York, moments of silence will be observed at Ground Zero to mark the time when the hijacked planes hit the World Trade Center and to mark when the towers fell. A reading of the victims' names will also be held at Ground Zero. But today on Democracy Now! We look at a group of victims that are often forgotten in the September 11th narrative. The many rescue workers who have since become sick after being exposed to contaminants at Ground Zero. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney of New York. She's the sponsor of the 9/11 Health and Compensation Act, which would provide permanent health treatment and compensation for all 9/11 Ground Zero workers and residents who become sick from their exposures to contaminants. But first, we want to turn to the story of Joe Pecoro, an iron worker from New Jersey.
Joe Pecoro was one of thousands of men and women who showed up at Ground Zero on September 11th to help with the rescue and recovery efforts. He was 34 years old at the time. Now Joe's dying. His doctor has told him he has the lungs of a 95-year-old. His lungs are so inflamed from all the tiny particles of glass and even human bone fragments lodged in them that every breath produces excruciating pain. He's been unable to work for the last 5 years and takes 37 different medicines. Juan, you wrote about Joe Pecoro in this week's New York Daily News column that was called Time to Rescue Our 9/11 Heroes Ill from Ground Zero Cleanup. Joe is joining us now from New Jersey. Juan?
Yes, and Joe, tell us some of the story. First, how you got to Ground Zero, and then what were the effects, how long it took for you to realize how sick you were.
I left for around midnight. I left my house, and I watched like everybody else on the TV. I watched the towers go down, and I have policemen and firemen in my family, and I knew the kind of equipment they carried, and I knew they didn't have the kind of equipment to cut that steel. So I grabbed some of my tools, and I jumped in my car, and I went up there, and.
And you lived in Tom's River, New Jersey, right? That's about, what, 60 miles from New York?
Yeah, about 68 miles, something like that. And I threw my tools in, and I walked into, into hell, into surreal. I never seen anything like it. There was, I was literally tripping over body parts. It was we were putting them in 5-gallon buckets for the first couple of hours I was there. And it was bad. And I stayed there 28 days. I stayed there 14 days total. at first, and I came home for 8 days, and I went back for another 14 days. The first couple of days, I slept on the floor of the American Express building because they didn't have anywhere else for us to sleep, and that I knew about anyway. And so I slept in the dust and the glass of the American Express building when I could. And
Joe, you started coughing the first day?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, within minutes you got down there, you started coughing. All the air was filled with dust still, and, you know, every time you moved, you kicked up dust. I mean, it was knee-deep in some spots, you know. It was pretty surreal, you know. You couldn't see what you were stepping on, what you're tripping over. It was part of the street fell in. Me and a bunch of firemen started running, and they grabbed me and said, run, and the street was falling in, and I ran, and then I realized I was running alone. They were running back, so I turned around and went back with them.
Joe, tell us your condition today. This is the 8th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. It's actually just down the road from where we are now. We were the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero in this big old 100-year-old firehouse that also our colleagues opened up for people just running down the road to give them water, to let them have access to the phone. Today, Joe, 8 years later.
Well, right now I'm hooked up to my oxygen machine. My lungs are, I went to the doctor yesterday, and it was we didn't get good news. So basically, the doctor said, you know, if he could get me another year or two, you know, he would, you know, he'd be surprised. And so I'm on 37 medications. Well, actually 39. He put me on two more when I went to see him yesterday. And you know, most of my problems come from my lungs, but my whole body is racked with pain. All my joints, it's just like a laundry list of problems. That, you know, if it's not one thing, it's another. You know, breathing, like I said, is the hardest. Like I said, I'm hooked up to oxygen now. My lungs have concrete and glass and human bone fragments in them. And, you know, so what happens is your lungs are the only organ that rejuvenate themselves. And mine, instead of growing viable lung tissue, they're growing, it's growing scar tissue. So it's making my lungs get bigger and bigger. And when I take a deep breath, my lungs actually rub against my ribs and it hurts.
And you also have problems of constantly vomiting, and also could you talk about the other problems that you've had?
I go through these vomiting bouts where my throat is torn up from the glass and the stuff I inhaled and also from throwing up, and it's caused my teeth to rot from throwing up and the medicine that I'm on. I had to have a tooth pulled just last month.
Joe, I know you were supposed to be picked up by the mayor this morning to go to a 9/11 memorial, but you're now too sick to go with him. What kind of compensation have you gotten over this last 8 years?
We fought for, me and my wife fought for 4 years, I think, almost 4 years, just to get workman's comp, which was originally started at $125 every 2 weeks, $125 every 2 weeks. And then we went back into court, and I got it bumped up to $250 every 2 weeks. So I get a total of $500. Excuse me. I get a total of $500 a month from New York as compensation.
How much does your medication cost you?
It doesn't cost me anything, thank God. they do pay for my medication. It comes from IWP, Injured Workers Pharmacy, and it comes through the mail. As a matter of fact, I'm waiting for a delivery this morning. Some of my pain medication and some of my new breathing medication is coming this morning.
Joe, we're going to break, and then we're going to come back to this discussion for 60 seconds. We'll break. Joe Pecoro, former freelance iron worker, worked at Ground Zero starting 9/11. He just raced from New Jersey to what's known as the pile just down the road from here, known as Hoboken Joe the Iron Worker. And he slept on the floor of the Amex building and others for 2 weeks as he tried to help. Here at the site of the attacks. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, and for all the footage that we are playing throughout this broadcast, especially for our radio listeners, you can look at it at our website at democracynow.org. John Alpert, who runs the Downtown Community Television Center with Keiko Tsuno here at the firehouse, took this footage on that first day and the first days. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we bring into the conversation with Joe Pecoro, the freelance iron worker who came to Ground Zero on 9/11 and stayed for weeks. Two other guests, Democratic Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney joins us here in the firehouse, co-sponsor of the 9/11 Health and Compensation Act. And we're joined by Dr. Jacqueline Moline, director of the World Trade Center Medical Monitoring and Treatment Program at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Carolyn Maloney, you have introduced legislation that does what?
Well, I've introduced legislation for 7 years. We know that on 9/11, almost 3,000 people died, but thousands more lost their health, like Joe. And it has been progressive, and has not been the support and help for them. Along with the New York delegation, we have secured funding for special programs such as the Mount Sinai program and the Bellevue program and other programs, centers for excellence, we call them. But it's a fight every year. We need a long-term program to help people like Joe. And we remember those days. I remember the signs looking missing, looking for people that were missing. But there were more signs for iron workers than anything else. Iron workers, report to duty. Retired iron workers, where are you? Iron workers, come, help, help, help. Well, many came like Joe. They were not paid. Many were volunteers. People came from all over the country. It's just not New York workers, but New Jersey. I did a study out of the 435 congressional seats, 432 congressional seats sent workers, volunteers, to work at Ground Zero. And the bill would cover monitoring for everyone who was exposed to the deadly toxins. It wasn't air. It was like Juan described it. It was soup. You could literally eat it. It was thick. So everyone who was exposed, and treatment for everyone who was sick. And it reopens the Victims Compensation Board. The Victims Compensation Board helped the families, the innocent families and victims and the firefighters and officers and police and volunteers who died that day. But in a sense, those who made a decision to walk into the flames, they made just as much of a sacrifice, and many, many, many are sick and dying like Joe.
Well, I want to play a short excerpt from a 2007 congressional hearing when the former head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Christy Todd Whitman, denied misleading the public over environmental dangers after 9/11. Whitman and John Henshaw, the former head of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, were questioned by Congressman Gerald Nadler.
In a series of EPA press releases beginning on September 13th, the following words were used to describe the air conditions. Good news, causes no concern, not detectable, no significant health risk, and safe to breathe. Ms. Whitman, do these words and phrases convey a sense of danger or even of caution, or do they in fact convey a sense of safety and security?
Mr. Chairman, those words, to the best of my recollection and every effort that I made at the time, were also added with the phrase, however, on the pile, it is different.
Well, we'll get to that.
There's a significant difference. The readings we were getting.
Excuse me, we will get to that, please. We only have a few minutes.
Answer
my questions. Do they convey a sense of safety and security or a sense of caution?
They convey exactly what they were meant to convey.
Okay.
Those were the readings we were getting from the scientists.
Do you regret your repeated assurances the air was safe to breathe?
I do not regret repeating what
okay.
the scientists said was appropriate
to say. Mr. Henshaw, do these words and phrases convey a sense of danger or even of caution, or do they convey a sense of safety and security, in your opinion?
Again, not counting the pile. The pile was a separate
circumstance. We'll get to the pile.
All right. We took 240 samples.
Please, answer the question. We'll
all of our samples were significantly below our permissible exposure limit.
You said that already. It's on the record. I just ask you if this conveyed a sense of safety.
That conveys that the environment is safe.
Okay, thank you. Do you now regret saying it was safe for New Yorkers to go back to work 6 days after the terrorist attack? Was that a mistake?
Not within the financial district. On the pile was a different circumstance. Sir, I do not regret
that. But in the area around it, it was okay?
All of our data indicated that it was okay.
That was Henshaw, the head of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, being questioned by New York Congressmember Gerald Nadler. Before that, Christine Todd Whitman, who is the head of the EPA. Juan, you did a lot of the original expose on the consequences of the World Trade Center collapse and wrote a book called Fallout, exposing Christine Todd Whitman.
Yes, and I'd like to ask Congresswoman Maloney now. Obviously, it's been years now, and Christy Todd Whitman is long gone. But the impact on the public and on the workers of these erroneous pronouncements by federal officials then?
Oh, I think it costs lives. It costs people are dying. They're sick. Government should have provided more safety measures and more preventive measures. I was down on 9/12. There were no masks. People were just working in the debris. As Joe said, it was almost like walking through snow. It was like something I've never seen. You would walk through this. It's not mist. It was like walking through a soup up to your knees, and the air was very, very thick. Many are sick, and we don't know the long-term impact, the cancers that may be there. That's why the bill is for 30 years to cover not only now, but other illnesses that may and will develop because of the exposure to these toxins.
Well, speaking of the cancers and the illness, we go now to Dr. Jacqueline Moline, director of the World Trade Center Medical Monitoring and Treatment Program at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Dr. Moline, welcome to Democracy Now! Tell us what you have found, the number of people you have worked with, and your latest discoveries.
Well, in our consortium, our centers of excellence, we are following about 27,000 folks. We've seen them in for a monitor and exam and continue to follow them with annual exams. We've been doing this since 2002, thanks to Congresswoman Maloney and the leadership she has shown in getting the funds to these programs so that we can have these programs. And also, we've been able to treat them with federal funds since 2006. What we're seeing are problems of the respiratory tract, of the upper respiratory tract, the lower respiratory tract, gastroesophageal reflux disease, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, depression. These problems that began in 2001 continue to 2009 and will continue in the years to come. What we're also seeing is unusual patterns of of disease presentation. We just recently published a paper that showed that we saw a group of younger workers at the site who developed a cancer of the immune system, a multiple myeloma. And while it's premature to be able to say that rates in general are elevated as a result of the exposures, what we're seeing is an unusual age distribution. It's a cancer usually we see in 60 or 70-year-old folks. And we saw four people under the age of 45. We've also seen other folks who are in the younger age category, much higher than we would expect. We would expect one person with cancer under 45 in the size of the population that we're following. We're on the alert for emerging diseases. We're on the alert for disease patterns that are unusual. The severity of disease that some people are showing is unexpected. And that's why it is so critical for us to have this long-term funding. It isn't just something that happened in the first weeks and months or even in the first few years. What we need to do is be able to follow the health of folks as we move into a period of time where any long-term diseases that might occur will start manifesting themselves.
And Dr. Moline, you are monitoring a total of about 28,000 people who worked on the pile?
Between Mount Sinai and our partners, we have seen almost 28,000 folks that have come through for a monitoring examination. An additional 15,000 individuals who worked for the fire department are seen in their program. There are also some folks who are being treated who lived or worked in the environment.
And Joe Picoro, in the last few minutes that we have, your hope for what this legislation might be able to do for you and others like you who are, continue to suffer?
Well, I hope it passes. I hope the bill passes. I'd like to say, first of all, to Mrs. Maloney, Congresswoman Maloney, if there ever is a mold to make politicians, they should start with her. She is absolutely fantastic, and her fight for us has been, unwavering. And also Dr. Moline, she's met me before. I know who she is, and she's been fighting for us also. And I really appreciate it. I wanted to get that out. But Dr. Moline said, the different diseases, the gastro reflux and all that, I have all those things. And, like my doctor said, I have the lungs of a 95-year-old man. Now, she said about age, we're aging and our bodies are aging way before they're supposed to, and like I said, the doctor gave me a year or so to live, a year or two to live. We need to get this straight. We need to straighten this out. We need to get the funding. We need to get the James Droga bill passed. I've been saying this for year after year. So is Mrs. Maloney and also Mrs. Molina, that it has to be passed. And yet it never seems to make it. It never seems to get passed. And I don't understand why. I don't know. I mean, we were there for them when they needed us. And, they told us that Christine Whitman stood there, and I don't care what she says about, she said the pile was different. She's a liar. I was standing there. She did not say that the air was different on the pile. She stood on the pile with her mask below her neck and talked to us and told us we were heroes and said the air was fine. And she put the mask back on, and she got back in her car, and she left, and went back to New Jersey where it was safe. So she's a liar, and that's all she is.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Joe Picoro, thanks so much for being with us. Joe, iron worker at Ground Zero, stayed a total of about a month working here as a volunteer to try to help. Congressmember Carolyn Maloney, Democratic congressmember from New York, co-sponsor of the 9/11 Health and Compensation Act, and Dr. Jacqueline Moline, director of the World Trade Center Medical Monitoring and Treatment Program at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. As we broadcast this show, we are just minutes from the actual anniversary, 8 years ago at this time, of the 9/11 attacks. Juan?
Well, the private military contractor Triple Canopy is at the center of a new controversy in Iraq. A 25-year-old employee named Adam Hermanson died 10 days ago after apparently being electrocuted while taking a shower in his quarters at Triple Canopy's base inside the Green Zone in Baghdad. Hermanson's family is alleging Triple Canopy misled them about how he died, perhaps to cover up faulty electrical wiring at the firm's facilities.
We called Triple Canopy yesterday, but they refused to answer any questions regarding the case. They emailed us a short statement saying, quote, an employee died from a non-combat incident, and the company was, quote, cooperating fully with the investigation. They added, we're saddened at this terrible loss and offer our deepest condolences to his family. Well, independent journalist and Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill broke the story about Adam Hermanson in The Nation magazine. Yesterday, I spoke with Jeremy, as well as Adam Hermanson's mother, Patricia, and his younger brother, Jesse. I began by asking Jeremy to lay out the story.
Well, I got an email from a young man named Jesse, who told me that his brother had died in Iraq and was working for a private military company called Triple Canopy, and that it appeared as though his brother had died of electrocution. And in this message that I got, it was indicated that the company Triple Canopy may have told the family one version of events that was then showing not to be true, that the young man did not have marks on his bed where he was found. The family later learned that he was found in a shower. And what drew my attention immediately to this, other than the fact that I was getting an email from someone saying that his brother had died under these mysterious circumstances, is that I've covered the electrocution problem in Iraq, where you have, since 2003, 18 U.S. soldiers and contractors have died from electrocution, several of them in showers. And the company that's been at the center of this, KBR, has been, which is the largest contractor in Iraq, former Halliburton subsidiary, has been under a congressional investigation for months now. Senator Byron Dorgan, Senator Bob Casey, and others have been investigating them. And the military right now is doing a review of 90,000 facilities that KBR runs and did the electrical wiring for in Iraq. So this is a problem that is reaching almost pandemic proportions. The most high profile of these deaths thus far has been a Green Beret named Ryan Maseth, who the Army investigators, the Pentagon investigators, determined it to be criminal negligence, but ultimately then the Pentagon decided not to press charges against anyone from KBR. So the context for it is that here we have another young man who had served 6 years in the United States Air Force, started working as a contractor earlier this year for Triple Canopy, is in Iraq, and then his family says that he died from electric shock in a shower.
And this company, Triple Canopy?
Triple Canopy is now the new Blackwater in Iraq. It is the company that the Obama administration has selected to take over most of Blackwater's security contracts in Iraq. So they're a huge, essentially mercenary company. But my understanding is that Adam was working, doing training for Triple Canopy, and was not a security operator escorting U.S. diplomats, but that he was working on some kind of a training contract for Triple Canopy. This is now the company that is getting many of the huge contracts for security in Iraq in the aftermath of all of the Blackwater scandals. One thing that I have to say, though, it's unclear who wired the building where Adam died, did the electrical wiring. In fact, a KBR spokesperson issued an emphatic denial yesterday to me, saying that KBR didn't wire the building, had nothing to do with it, wasn't involved with the maintenance of it. The Pentagon would not return my calls asking for them to confirm or deny KBR's version of events.
Again, Patricia and Jesse, thanks so much for joining us, because I know how difficult this must be for you. Patricia, tell us how you learned about Adam's death.
They phoned me, and I thought it was Adam calling because I hadn't heard from him for a week and a half, and I noticed the number, and it seemed like the number he had used before. And I was in a movie theater, and I ran out because I missed it, and I called right back. And the person who answered said, this is Triple Canopy, Jeff Wilczek, whatever. And he says, are you Patricia Hermanson? And I said, yes. And your son is Adam Hermanson? And I said, yes. And I says, what's wrong? What happened? And he says, I have to inform you that your son was found collapsed by his bed, and efforts to revive him were unsuccessful.
How old?
And Adam was 25 years old.
He just turned 25.
Just turned 25.
health problems?
Very healthy. Mm-hmm. Healthy, as I said before, strong as a tank. Healthy, highly trained, and he was good at everything he did. And
he had been in the military.
He had been in the military for 6 years, and he served in the security forces. And he was deployed to Iraq 3 times and to Afghanistan once. And each time, as a mother would do, I worried because I knew he was in harm's way each and every time. I was afraid for that one call. I was afraid for somebody to come to my door and tell me something happened to him. But when this happened, and the way it happened, and everything else, it's not the way that I thought anything.
Did they say why he collapsed?
They didn't say why he collapsed. And when they were asked if he, by my brother, who asked questions for me, they asked if there, my brother asked if there's any bruises or marks on his body, anything that
physical marks that would
show any kind of, you know, accident or just reveal anything. And they said there was no marks whatsoever. And then we get pictures, which I can't look at, that show visible physical marks on his left hand. One consists of a blackish kind of discoloration on his left hand, and then on the outside of his left hand was a mark of wound of some kind, and then it led up his arm where there supposedly was an exit wound, which was open. So it's there, you can see the conflicting story too already, where he was found and wounds on his body and marks, and they said no.
Patricia Hermanson is the mother of Adam Hermanson, who died 10 days ago after being electrocuted while taking a shower in his living quarters at Triple Canopy's base in Baghdad. He was 25 years old. When we come back, we'll also speak with his 17-year-old brother, Jesse. Stay with us.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you.
Buffy St. Marie singing live in our studio here, Universal Soldier. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Yesterday, Jeremy Scahill came into our studio with Patricia and Jesse Hermanson. Patricia lost her son, Adam Hermanson, in Iraq. He was 25 years old on September 1st. He was apparently electrocuted while he took a shower. I asked Jesse, Adam's 17-year-old brother, how he and his mother found out Adam had died.
September 1st, it was around 2:30 or 2:45, and I had got a voicemail, and I didn't listen to it until about 3:15, and once I had heard about that, you know, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know why, you know, it's my big brother, and, you know, and my mom, she's really, you know, frantic, and, you know, just, I never heard my mom like that before, you know, and, I called my uncle and I asked him, you know, is this real? You know, is this really going on? And he says, yes, your brother's gone, you know. And the voicemail that she had left me said, Jesse, your brother's dead. And she's, you know, hysterical and crying, you know, all that. And so it's, you know, I broke down myself. And, you know, I find out later that my mom, you know, went into the hospital. But, yeah.
And what have you found out since that day, since September 1st?
There's been a lot of conflicting stories. You know, we're looking for a straight answer, and they haven't gave us a straight answer for anything. You know, Triple Canopy hasn't informed us about any of this. There was, you know, just a couple people that I have been talking to. They found out they found out more information on September 2nd than we have in the last week and a half, you know, since it had happened. So, you know, it's just...
I might mention that shortly after we arrived at Dover, Delaware, the person from Triple Canopy, or who represents Triple Canopy, the bereavement...
Dr. Martin,
came to us the second day we were there and said, well, I have some information. They have removed all the plumbing, the water heater, the electrical wiring. And so I said, okay, all right. I said, you're going there with this. That's all. That he didn't tell us anything else except for that. And that was the only piece of information that we had until we found out that he actually did have. And that was when his body arrived with a mortician.
And who actually saw, as we show these photographs, who took these photographs of your son?
Myself and my cousin and my uncle.
At the funeral home. Funeral home.
Were you surprised, Jesse?
Well, they had, yeah, I mean, because they told us that there was no physical marks or anything when we had asked them. And they had clarified, you know, and said again and again that there was no marks on his body. And, you know, and obviously they had just straight out lied to us.
Jeremy.
When I first started talking to Jesse and his cousin, they were in the process of gathering this information. And I believe the first time that you really learned that there were these marks was when you talked to the mortician at the private funeral home.
Yeah, we had to find out by ourselves. Me and my cousin stayed behind. We had asked him, is there any physical marks and whatnot? And he said, well, yes, you know, up on his left arm all the way from his hand. His forearm all the way up to his bicep, you know, up here in that general area.
And then after that, then Janine Hermanson, Adam Hermanson's wife, spoke to the medical examiner from the military. She also, Janine Hermanson, was in the Air Force for 4 years. That's where she met her husband. And the primary reason that Adam had signed up to work with Triple Canopy is that they planned on buying a house together in Pennsylvania. And he was basically going for a 4-month contract. He was, my understanding, getting paid somewhere around $300 a day to work for Triple Canopy in Iraq. And his plan, as I understand it, Patricia, was that he was going to come back then and try to put a down payment down on a house so that they could sort of start their life back in the United States. So when Janine talked to the medical examiner from the military, the medical examiner said, you know, this is preliminary because we have to do the toxicology reports, but it appears that the cause of death was a electric shock, a low voltage electric shock. And that was what the medical examiner told her. So that then concurs with what Jesse and others heard from the mortician, who said it appeared as though there were these electric burns on his left hand and going up his arm.
You're getting a private autopsy done?
We did have a private autopsy done.
And what are the results?
We don't have any results.
We haven't got them back yet, but it should be soon. But they also had said that there was still a low electrical current in his body, you know, and
when he was found?
Yeah, no, just when they did the autopsy, the first autopsy. And
to be clear, Jeff Wilczak of Triple Canopy mm-hmm. told you he collapsed by his bed.
That's the first thing he told me.
And then what happened? What did you learn the next day?
My brother asked the question again, and then that's when it changed to the shower, that he was found by the shower. And
there was just conflicting stories anyways, that his roommate had found him and a coworker had also found him. You know, we haven't gotten any straight answers from Triple Canopy.
Have you been able to talk to the other people served with or worked with?
What happened is that because of the change in stories, we were told not to talk to Jeff anymore, but instead talk to Dr. Mike Martin.
This was a bereavement counselor that Triple Canopy sent down to Dover to be with the family.
So we were actually, you know, told don't talk to Jeff anymore.
Yeah, they told us no longer to ask any more questions, basically not to deal with Jeff Wilczak. That Dr. Martin, if you have any more questions or anything, that it would all go through him.
Yeah, I called Triple Canopy yesterday repeatedly through the day, and I emailed them, and eventually a spokesperson emailed a statement back that said that expressed condolences for Adam's death and said that Triple Canopy wasn't going to be issuing any comments until the investigation was complete. And then later in the day, I followed up, and I wrote back to the spokesperson, and I said, I just have one question for you. Who did the electrical wiring in the building? Did KBR do it? Did you do it? Meaning Triple Canopy, or did you have another outside contractor? And the spokesperson wrote back and said, I don't have any information that I can give you on that right now, and I would appreciate it if you just use the original statement that I sent you.
Which was?
Which was just expressing condolences and saying that we're not going to issue any statements on this. I mean, one of the crucial, among many questions that this family has every right to ask, one of the crucial questions right now, who did that electrical wiring? That's a key question to know because of this broader problem that we've seen in Iraq.
And Jeremy, explain exactly where this building was.
Well, this is, the one of the terrible, tragic ironies of this is that Adam was a combat vet who had been in Iraq, had been in Uzbekistan, had been in other places, and he is in the most secure, fortified fortress that the U.S. military has on planet Earth, inside of the green zone, where they have swimming pools and cappuccino and fast food and all these things. So he doesn't die outside of the green zone, in combat or IED, improvised explosive device. He dies apparently taking a shower in this heavily fortified fortress. He was in Camp Olympia, which is essentially the sort of private operating base of Triple Canopy. You know, they put up these makeshift buildings so fast, and the whole idea is just you get up these sort of trailers or sort of shack type things, or big warehouses that are put up instantly, and they wire them with electricity, and they put the water in there, and a lot of times it's done just really, really fast. That's how a lot of these problems go down in Iraq. The other thing is that a lot of the electricians that have been hired to do this work on thousands and thousands of facilities, according to KBR's own electricians in front of Congress, are not even up to code with U.S. and U.K. standards. They're hiring electricians from Bangladesh and other countries that don't even have certification to do this kind of work in the United States, and yet they're wiring buildings for U.S. soldiers and contractors.
And again, how many people have died of electrocution in Iraq?
18 that we know of. Who knows more? But there also were, I think, 90 reports in 2008, 94 reports, I think it is, of soldiers seeking medical help, U.S. soldiers seeking medical help for electric shock-related injuries. And according to KBR's own data, there were more than 200 instances of these kinds of shocks that occurred.
And Patricia, how long had Adam been in Iraq?
Around 3 months. And I must say that I practically begged him not to go.
Yeah, tell us about how he went from being a soldier to working for Triple Canopy.
Well, when he got out of the military, he went to Las Vegas, where we live, and he worked as a private protector, bodyguard for a billionaire. And he put in different applications to work with different Metro Highway Patrol and
North Las Vegas Police Department.
Yes, and he was getting impatient and didn't want to wait for them because of all this hiring freeze. So he was looking into it, and he would mention it about these people. And I was the whole family was very leery. Everybody in our family, it's a close-knit family, told him those people, that's a bad organization. Triple Canopy is just an extension of Blackwater, and they have a bad reputation, and it's dangerous, and you shouldn't have anything to do with them. But Adam, he actually signed up and joined without telling me until about a day and a half before he left. And
you thought he was in Kuwait.
Yes, he did. He tried to protect me from worrying, as I have worried for the 6 years that he was in harm's way in the military, and I thought that he was in Kuwait, and he didn't want to worry me, and he told me, Mom, he goes, don't worry about me. I'm going to be in Kuwait.
It'll be a piece of cake.
It'll be a piece of cake.
Jesse, did you know he had gone into Iraq?
He had told me. I guess my cousin had found out first, and I had found out about a week and a half before, and I tried talking him out of it, telling him it wasn't worth it. Just stay here, just stay with the family. And, he was a big family guy. That's all he did was protect us. He was a protector. And he was a natural born leader. He was a warrior. You know, it was just, it's not right.
I must say too, when I talked to him last, I asked him, I said, well, how is it going there, Adam? And he says, well, Mom, you know, I really can't say. And I said, well, you know, you just watch your back and be careful and don't trust anybody. And he says, oh, you know, that's the way I am. And I said, okay. And he says, well, you know, I'm thinking seriously about getting out and being home by November. And I said, good, Adam. I said, I want you should be home. I always had a bad feeling about these people that he was working for.
Finally, did the U.S. government call you? And then I want to ask Jeremy what it means to work for one of these military contractors in terms of U.S. government liability in a U.S. war zone in a place like Iraq or Afghanistan. Has the U.S. government called you?
No. Nobody has called us except for Triple Canopy. That's and we've mostly been talking to their you know, bereavement psychologist
we
who has made
him,
our arrangements over here.
Yeah, we ask him question after question. You know, he just doesn't give anything out. You know, it's I guess he's been told, you know, to talk, say anything about this case or what, you know, whatnot. I don't know.
I mean, you know, the fact that your brother also had residence in Nevada, or, you know, at a point. I mean, Harry Reid is the most powerful person in the United States Senate. He represents the state of Nevada. This should be Harry Reid's business. Harry Reid should be involved with this. He should be looking at this immediately. I know that Senator Byron Dorgan's office and some others are looking into this case right now, and they've been on this issue for quite some time. But this death needs to be investigated thoroughly, and the representatives of the state of Nevada have an obligation to this family to take it up.
And what about the way these military contractors fit into the war picture?
Well, what's
whose
incredibly
responsibility are the deaths, ultimately?
I mean, what's really, really heartbreaking also about Adam's story is how common it is in terms of why he joined up with Triple Canopy. You've got these guys that spend their whole lives, as Patricia says, they're training to be warriors. I mean, he wasn't just in the U.S. Air Force. He was in the security forces of the United States Air Force and was a guy who had all sorts of certifications and advanced training and was working as a bodyguard. But these companies dangle the money in front of you. And they say, hey, man, you can go into the war zone. You can be there 3 or 4 months. You can get that money to put a down payment, to open that gym, in the case of Scott Helvenston, who died working for Blackwater. It's like we hear this story over and over, and these guys go over there, and they work for these companies that are literally making a killing off of this war. Yeah, they pay the guys a few hundred dollars a day, and it seems like really good money, but relative to what the companies make, it's peanuts, you know, in terms of the profits that these companies turn. So they take these guys, and they put them in these war zones, and they have very little accountability for the forces when they go out into the field and end up, you know, interacting with civilians. In the case of Blackwater, when they, you know, shoot civilians, what have you. Triple Canopy also has a very questionable history in that regard. So on the one level, you have that there's no accountability for the individual guys who are doing the shooting on the ground, but then there's no accountability for the company. I mean, you look at Eric Prince, the owner of Blackwater. He's faced no consequences thus far legally for any of the actions. It's ironic that it's left up to lawyers suing these companies to try to get any semblance of justice for either the victims on the civilian side or the victims of end up working for these companies and die under mysterious circumstances. This is an utter scandal that this has not been confronted by the Congress or by the military, for that matter, or the State Department, which gives these huge contracts out.
After Amy Goodman conducted this interview yesterday, the Pentagon gave its first statement on Adam Hermanson's death. Major Sean Turner, a Pentagon spokesperson, told The Nation magazine, quote, "It appears as though our first thinking is that local nationals were responsible for the wiring there." Major Turner said there is no indication that U.S. forces will be launching a formal investigation. Even though Hermanson was working for Triple Canopy on a Department of Defense contract, his death, Major Turner said, took place at a facility that, quote, does not fall under DOD responsibility. And that does it for today's program. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.